In fact, I have completely changed the title of what I'm going to talk to you about. What's the HLF for? Is something that people occasionally say to us with not an entirely friendly intention. So I thought instead I would ask a different question, and I would ask the question, whose heritage? It's not unconnected, but just to warn you that among my controversial activities, I include not always doing what people ask me to do. Generally, when people ask what we're for, it's usually with exasperation, and it's because we're not doing the job they think we should be doing. And often this entails not giving their particular bit of the heritage the funding that they think it needs and deserves. The director of one national institution recently said we ought to spend half of our annual budget of about £330 million on buying art. There's a submission to the current Select Committee inquiry into the heritage which accuses us of neglecting our duty towards historic ships. And we're regularly berated by the churches for not spending a proportion of our funding equal to the proportion of listed buildings which are churches. Now, I've got absolutely every sympathy with all of those interest groups. Those are three perfectly reasonable points of view. We could easily and happily give out three times the 330 million we currently do every year and still not please everyone or meet the need. But there is often a fundamental misunderstanding about what we're here to do and how behind these complaints. And what I'd like to try to do this afternoon is to dispel some of that misunderstanding in answering the question that I chose to address instead of the one you asked me, whose heritage? As many of you will know, the Heritage Lottery Fund is a young organisation. It was set up just 11 years ago to distribute the heritage share of the National Lottery. It was an acknowledgement then that the nation's heritage, our physical and cultural fabric, was just not winning the argument against schools and hospitals for the finite pot of Exchequer funding. And that's completely understandable. If you've got a choice between a kidney machine and a historic building, item by item, the kidney machine wins every time. It has to. And the brilliant idea of the National Lottery was to say there are some things that as a society we recognise are absolutely important, we want to do them, let us fund them separately, let us give them their own stream of money out of the lottery and stop the argument. I think that was an absolutely visionary move, and it was, goodness knows, badly needed. The backlog of investment in museums and galleries alone meant that many were frankly pretty dreadful. Absolutely dedicated staff working among dusty glass cases, limited interpretation, the vast majority of the collection kept hidden in unsuitable storage, people having to come in at weekends with mops and buckets if it rained to rescue it, and often the most basic of facilities for visitors. I think it was no wonder that museums were seen by really quite a large chunk of the population as not for them. And that's not to mention the huge funding deficit there was too in historic parks and landscapes, industrial transport and maritime heritage, libraries and archives, and much more. But while we all knew back then how desperately needed the lottery was, I don't think anyone foresaw just how big an impact it would have. In its very first year, the Heritage Lottery Fund received £306 million, committing more money to heritage than its parent organisation, then as now, the National Heritage Memorial Fund, had committed in the whole of its 15-year history. And being a new organisation, distributing an entirely new stream of money, meant that the HLF had the huge advantage of starting with a clean slate, and from the beginning, it was able to be radical. The unique nature of the lottery good causes, funded each week by millions of ordinary people choosing to play, entailed the HLF developing a way of working that kept it close and responsive to this pool of funders. There's a subtle relationship between people's readiness to buy tickets and how well the good causes are doing, I think. Undoubtedly, most people play the lottery in order to win millions and millions of pounds. But if lottery distributors are seen to be doing things that the lottery players don't like, you can, I believe, see the effect in ticket sales. So the HLF knew from the beginning that it needed to keep close to those ticket buyers. And I think the most significant way that the trustees do that is to refuse to define heritage, the very thing we're there to fund. Instead of doing that ourselves, to draw a box round what we define as heritage, we leave that responsibility with the people and the organisations that apply to us for money. You want money from us? You tell us what it is you value from the past so much that you want to hand it on to the future generations and why. And so long as you fulfil two other big conditions, you're in with a chance. The two other big conditions are firstly that it must be sustainable. It's no good us giving you money to do something which in two or three years will simply fall over. There has to be a sustainable way of keeping it going. And secondly, you have to show us how you're going to share this precious thing with people who aren't already in the group. You can come to us for funding for steam engines, that's terrific. But you have to show us how you're going to make steam engines attractive and interesting to people who aren't already enthusiasts. And that's a bit of a cliff for some people to climb, but I think one of the perhaps the most valuable thing, no, that's going too far. It's a very valuable aspect of what the Heritage Lottery Fund funding has done. 11 years ago, if you'd asked anyone to define heritage, I think you would have got back a somewhat narrow, certainly expert-led view that would have encompassed the built heritage, country houses, castles and cathedrals, plus museums and galleries and the art and artifacts that they held. Perhaps a bit of archaeology and archives, but not an awful lot else. Yet the public, the people of these islands, know that their heritage is deeper and broader and richer than all of that, important though it is. Yes, the magnificent country houses and castles, but also the historic urban parks that were the product of the Victorian public parks movement. The canals, the pits, the warehouses and mills that tell the story of our industrial past, the steam trains, the T-clippers and World War II planes of our transport heritage, the historic everyday buildings that are at the heart of our towns and cities, the landscapes and species that are the natural heritage of our countryside, the oral histories, dialects and cultural traditions that make us who we are, and of course the local and regional archives, museums and other collections that allow us to investigate and discover them. All of these, undeniably, the very fibre of our history and heritage as people, communities and nations. The impact of these years of the lottery has been vast. £3.3 billion invested into 18,000 heritage projects. Some of them are tiny, some of them are enormous. But if you look around the country, it's very difficult to give people a kind of bird's eye view of what that all adds up to together. But it is something extraordinary and a huge transformation, I think. First and foremost, it's meant an enormous shot in the arm for the physical fabric of our showcase heritage. The Great Court of the British Museum, the Playfair extension at the National Galleries of Scotland in Edinburgh, the National Waterfront Museum in Swansea, Somerset House, Hadrian's Wall, Hackney Empire, that sort of thing. Bricks and mortar, most obviously, have benefited enormously. But I must also mention the 260-plus parks that are now back to their green, cared-for selves, resplendent with restored lakes and plantings, bandstands blooming with flowers and shrubs and trees, made safe and usable with park keepers, loos, cafes and children's playgrounds. All the red squirrels, basking sharks and horseshoe bats. I'm not very sound on bats myself, but there are people who think they are very, very important indeed, and we've done well by them, that have been conserved, or the land three times the size of the Isle of Wight, which has been bought and restored. Incidentally, all of this has made the HLF one of the biggest regeneration funders in the United Kingdom, helping to revive over 460 rundown areas in seaside towns, little market towns and urban centres. From Barrow to Bridgend, Great Yarmouth to Glasgow Merchant City, Nottingham Lace Market to the St George's Market in Belfast. The historic buildings, streetscapes, clock towers, fountains, architectural features that have become neglected have been restored and once again make these areas of character and interest where people want to live and shop and socialise, and crucially also where businesses want to locate and invest. But all of that, proud though we are of it, as you can tell from my boastful tone, is only half the story. Equally important is the revolution in attitudes to and perceptions of heritage that HLF funding has helped to bring about. We are by no means the only people who have been running down this road. Others have been striving mightily to go in that direction. But the fact that we could put large amounts of money on the table and say it's only available if you buy this idea, I do think has given it a huge shove forwards, requiring the heritage sector to move towards a more inclusive and democratic vision that takes into account people as well as objects. And this approach to heritage has brought about a major shift, ensuring that it's now reaching new audiences, not by dumbing down, certainly not by making theme parks, but by thinking creatively about the stories and the interests of different people and how the colours of heritage can change to reflect them. Increased visitor numbers at national museums are not simply the product of free entry, important though that has been, nor even of the vastly improved buildings they are housed in, but also of the inspiring programmes of renewal and redevelopment, education and access, which HLF has not only funded but insisted upon, and that challenge has been picked up with such energy by the museum sector. We encourage, some I'm sure would say we sometimes bully, our applicants to get as many people as possible actively involved in identifying and managing their heritage, as opposed to simply looking at it. There is, of course, a great deal of pleasure in just looking, but especially for people who aren't already enthusiasts, doing something active can have a wonderfully galvanising effect. Youth engagement, learning and social mixing are all products of this broad, including view of heritage. But don't take my word for it. We went to the think tank Demos and asked them to come and have a look at us in terms of the endless quest to find a vocabulary in which to address the treasury and demonstrate the beneficial effect of all this money. What are the outcomes? How do you demonstrate that a pound in on heritage is delivering absolutely anything to stand up beside a pound spent on hospitals? Well, of course, we didn't get there. Nobody ever does. But every time somebody does an exercise looking at the value of these intangible things, we get a little step nearer, the narrative gets a bit more interesting. And what Demos said about us was that the greatest achievement of the HLF had been to shift the idea of the value and importance of heritage away from being something that is exclusively determined by experts on behalf of society to one that recognises the importance of widespread participation in identifying and caring for what is valued collectively. The work of HLF has broadened the social base of the enjoyment of heritage so that there is now an acknowledged diversity of contributions to the national story. A statement of which we are immeasurably proud, but let us be honest, this is not uncontroversial. There are people who think that this is dumbing down, that it wastes money, that we spread the jam too thin, that we cheapen the idea of heritage with this approach. I absolutely reject this argument. Broadening understanding is not cheapening anything. Weaving the experience of ordinary people into the story of our national heritage enriches it, doesn't impoverish it. And extending the constituency of those who support, look after, and lobby for the heritage is, I do really believe, the key to its future sustainability. HLF experience has taught us that there are real specific benefits. First and foremost, I don't have to persuade you people of the benefits to society of a better understanding of our heritage, the bedrock on which we stand, learn, and develop. Our museums, libraries, and archives, in a particularly obvious way, are the repositories of the extraordinary and the everyday history of our nation, and in a changing world, we can only benefit from a deeper understanding of this rich heritage. We live in a time of enormous social and economic change where the traditional signposts, some may say the comfort zones, of class, religion, local labour markets have receded. A firmer grasp of heritage, where we've come from, how our towns and villages have grown up, our own family histories, and the heritage of people who move from their own physical roots to take up habitation in different places. All those things can provide a tether as the world whirls around our heads. We need only to look at the explosion of genealogical research on the internet to see the hunger that exists for this kind of knowledge. We know this isn't always proper research and is often inspired by simple snobbery or vanity or just curiosity. But so what? It starts to get people into archives and on the path. Of course, that raises new challenges in dealing with the expectations, at the same time vast and limited, of the Google generation. But if we are all enriched by a better understanding of history, so I think the plot of history is enriched, deepened, and thickened the more we all, expert and public alike, add to it and have access to it. We here know that history is not a closed book, but a developing and broadening knowledge. Heritage is organic. It moves with the society it stands for. The more people we can pull into our world of our history, the wider our horizons become. Similarly, as our understanding of our world develops and our world itself changes, so we have to revisit history, reinterpret it, reassess what it means for our present and our future. The 2007 anniversary of the parliamentary abolition of the transatlantic slave trade in British ships is an opportunity to revisit one of the most difficult parts of our history. You've just heard, some of you, from the National Maritime Museum, where we helped to buy a slave trade archive. And we're supporting many other projects connected to 2007, which are enabling new audiences to explore this complex story. We've also just heard from the Library and Museum of Freemasonry, a part of our history that was, by definition, both secret but also integral. We can only begin to understand how important because of this archive. And if society and history stand to gain from drawing in the public, so too do the institutions and the professional practitioners. Times have changed. There is no longer that destructive war between the so-called scholarly curators and the so-called vulgar marketeers. Now, time and again, we see projects where the involvement of the non-specialist, the enthusiastic amateur, not only brings benefits to those people getting involved for the first time, but also to the organisation itself, which finds a new audience, new and exciting interpretations of its collections, and crucially, a new body of people to love them, care for them, and give them a sustainable future. Getting the public involved adds significant extra value to our financial investment. Opening up archives and specialist collections may be a particularly challenging prospect on many levels, but it's also highly desirable. It's in the interest of everyone who cares about their quality and their future to do so. David Lammy, the Culture Minister, in a speech to a conference on public value that we hosted recently, identified the foundation of the Society for the Protection of Ancient Buildings, the National Trust, and the Campaign for the Preservation of Rural England as the beginnings of both a mass heritage movement but also of a political awareness of the importance of heritage. These two things, mass appeal and politicians sitting up and taking note, are of course not unconnected. We all know that our archives, especially local record offices, are too often underfunded, forgotten, housed in damp, decrepit buildings. Why? Because they're low on the political agenda. The only thing that will move them up that agenda is if the people that count, the electorate, value them and are prepared to stand up and shout about them. It shouldn't be so, but that's the way government works. And the more expert the view, at the moment it seems sometimes, the less likely it is to gain currency. It's perhaps no coincidence that earlier this year, the same minister, David Lammy, warned local authorities not to cut funding to library services, shortly after figures showed visits to public libraries had risen for the third year running, with the number of visits up by 17 million since 2001, even though we all may know these figures tell various stories. He hitched his wagon to what he knew was an increasingly popular cause. He said, "Communities continue to remind their councillors of the importance of libraries to them. It's important that I bang the drum for libraries and reading, just as you would expect an education minister to bang the drum for schools." So the more people there are in our archives, the more people there are telling politicians that they're important. Drawing people in means a bigger constituency to care and campaign for our heritage. Many of the parks that we've funded, for instance, have established friends groups as part of the process. And those groups serve as ambassadors, campaigners, volunteers. They roll up their sleeves and do whatever needs doing. Who would say no to that? Of course there are challenges. How do you bring large numbers of people into archives to look at precious, light-sensitive documents? How do you really involve young people who see research as sitting in front of a computer or mucking around with a video camera? How do you bring in people who've never before thought about archives, let alone used them, and who don't see people from their community working in them? Well, if you crack that nut and attract new people into your archives, how do you then ensure that they know what to do? How to make the most of what they see stretching before them. Here and there, museum and archive services, as we all know, have produced some absolutely triumphant examples of success. And I suppose you really couldn't look better than at the National Archives at Kew, which is a real model of how to deal with ordinary people, make them feel comfortable, encourage them to be ambitious in what they do, and manage to do it all at the same time as offering a decent service to the professionals and the historians who have always used the place. The West Yorkshire Archive Service is encouraging people in Bradford to get involved in creating the archives of the future, working with a city regeneration company to bring in local people, focusing on both the South Asian and the traditional Yorkshire communities, to produce community archives of everything from weddings in the Asian community to working life in Bradford Mills, thickening the plot. The next big challenge will be for the National Library of Scotland to make full use of the opportunity presented by the John Murray Archive, which has had a first stage grant from us of £17.5 million. It will not only tell the intellectual history of 19th century Britain from Byron to Darwin, but it has the potential to change the way the people of Scotland view their National Library. They plan to open the archive up with a whole new exhibition gallery in the National Library of Scotland, an education and outreach programme, loans to other libraries and touring exhibitions across the United Kingdom. Stuff you all know about, but for that very library, it's still the beginning of a process, and I hope that the arrival of this unbelievable archive is going to give them a real boost to get it going. The Birmingham City Archives Connecting Histories project that is exploring the hidden histories of the city's diverse communities. Unlocking archives which include the Birmingham Hebrew Congregation Archive, the Indian Workers Association Archive, and the Birmingham Trade Union Resource Centre Archive. Crucially here, employing an outreach worker so they don't just invite people in, they go out and proactively draw them in. And they've addressed the challenge of making their workforce more representative by funding two training placements for graduates from a BME background. Most of the 50 applicants for those posts, incidentally, applying because of the aims, content and ethos of the project, rather than simply an interest in a career in archives. Things are stirring all over the archive universe. And, of course, there is the IHR's own England's Past for Everyone project. I know David Cannadine won't mind me recalling that the first application for the project was rejected by HLF, precisely because we didn't think it went far enough in trying to open up the local archives it proposed to work on to new audiences. There are still tough challenges ahead, but if it succeeds, it will be a glorious example of how much pleasure history and heritage can bring to academics and lay people alike. As I said, none of this is rocket science. All of it, infinitely replicable and undeniably worth trying. Last year, HLF awarded over £345 million. Of this, £30 million went to archives and libraries, almost 10%. And although my colleagues would absolutely murder me for saying this because it will bring them nothing but trouble, you could, if you applied with energy and the right projects, get more. So it can be done, and we have seen again and again that it's worth doing for your sake and that of the history and the heritage. We are certainly not going to give up on pushing our applicants to go that bit further. We have seen for 11 years what that extra push can deliver. Not only the bricks and mortar of our built heritage being restored, our natural heritage saved, our histories gathered, but a whole new constituency of people passionate about heritage. That is something that was never imagined when the lottery was established, but which is one of the proudest parts of its legacy. As we now look towards the next 10 years of our existence, we're considering how we build on that legacy, and we're consulting on how we do that. In particular, we need to ask what we will, with a bit less money in future, do less of, and where there is greatest need. We will also ask how to make our funds more accessible and how we can sensibly give people a greater say in what we do. I know that many of you will have views on all of that, so I strongly encourage you to feed into our consultation, which is open to the end of this month, at hlf.org.uk. What you tell us will shape how we work over the next 10 years. And I hope that over that time you will continue to succeed with and enjoy projects that we've already funded and that you will come to us with many successful new applications. So whose heritage? Well, it's obvious, isn't it? We all own it. We all make it and remake it. We are all responsible for identifying where it has value. It belongs to all of us. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much indeed to Liz Forgan for a survey of the Heritage Lottery Fund, its history and its achievements, a powerful and progressive vision, and a glance towards the future. Liz Forgan has agreed to answer questions. I suggest, and her hand goes up even before my introduction has begun, I suggest that everyone, as they ask a question, identify themselves both by name and institutional affiliation. James.
First of all, I think it's worth saying that the Heritage Lottery Fund had a huge impact across the whole heritage sector, and in many ways for good. But I don't think that actually takes away from the fundamental question of mechanism. Is it the right mechanism to deliver these resources to the people out of community-based projects? You talked about showcase heritage projects, such as like the British Library, the British Museums, and so on and so forth. they're fantastic, but there is, I think, a basic political issue there, that is it right to fund these prestige projects based upon the actual tickets of people loving tickets on council sectors and poorest parts of the country? That, to me, is an issue of equity. I think that is something which politicians should need to actually focus on. And there's also the issue, I think, of accountability, which I think is problematic, and sustainability. Certainly all the heritage lottery projects I've seen and been involved in tangentially have all had the same problem. How is this statement? Because you might actually build and give up the art gallery extension, you might build new facilities, but how does it say in the long term when the fundamental problem is local authorities do not have the cash hanging around to pay for continued exhibitions and continued expansion in the long term, sometimes even to actually maintain the industry's exhibits. So I think there's issues there. And I think the basic problem is about local accountability. How can the National Quagga be accountable to the people, to all the communities it's supposed to serve around Britain? We know how diverse Britain is as a society. How can it deliver the rights and messages to them? How can it do it in an equitable basis? The bottom line is, my local authority builds a new museum, weighs £10 million.
Sorry, I think the question has been...
I have learnt to be extremely wary when somebody starts a question by paying the HLF a compliment. I always know there's going to be a sting in the tail, but I wasn't prepared for four stings. I will do my best. Let's start at the end. Accountability. The lottery distributors are not elected. However, we take very seriously the connection between us and, as I said, and lottery players. That is what I meant when I referred briefly to us thinking seriously in our next strategic plan about ways in which we can involve the public more directly than we presently do in our decision making. I am deeply against, in fact it's simply never going to happen, asking people to choose by ticking boxes between one project and another. That is simply a form of completely ersatz public consultation. The assessment of a Heritage Lottery Fund project is an immensely complicated issue, and the public simply, without devoting the 6 months that we devote to doing it, is not in a position to do that. Where I think we need to be really energetic, and we are, is in consulting the public at a strategic level. What is it about the heritage that you value? Where should our priorities be? And that is what we are doing at this very minute with this new consultation process. We did an exactly similar process before the last strategic plan. I also am thinking, and we haven't worked this out yet, so please don't tell the newspapers, I'm thinking about ways in which we can involve the public retrospectively in literally visiting HLF-funded projects after the fact and reporting back what they think of them. But there is no, we are not elected. There is no formal form of accountability in that way. We work subject to directions which are given to us by the elected government, but those are pretty broad. So I'm afraid you'll have to do the best you can with that. Sustainability, I have to say, I think this glass is pretty nearly full. When you think of what a challenge it is to run a heritage project, a park or a museum or a historic building, I do think that the fact that 11 years on, we have, touch wood, not yet had a major failure from the Heritage Lottery Fund is remarkable. And one of the reasons for that is that we give people a really hard time in looking at their business plans when they come to us for any kind of sizable amount of money. And we do bind local authorities into the process. But so this is getting a bit technical, but you asked a question which may be interesting to you. If, for example, local authorities asking us to fund a park, which they own, and it was indeed their responsibility to maintain it, but they haven't done it because they didn't have the funds. We will come and put in the capital funds to redo the park. We insist on a contribution from the local authority, but we permit them to express that in terms of 10 or longer years of guaranteed undertaking to maintain the park, a maintenance budget, which enables them then to build that into their forward planning, because it's levered in our capital funding. So that's a tricky one, but actually I think we're doing pretty well on that, and it's a very serious concern. There is no service to anybody in putting lottery players' money into projects which won't stay there for more than 5 minutes. Equity. Well, we have a mixture of approaches to different kinds of grants. We have identified in every region of England, Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland what we call cold spots, which are places calculated by a mixture of not having had money from us and social deprivation indexes. And those get particular attention from our development teams, who will go there and work really hard with people to try to make an infrastructure which is capable of formulating an application to us, which is sometimes a real problem. It is a subsidiary aim. We have three big strategic aims, and we have a fourth subsidiary aim, which is to spread the money equally around the country, as equally as we can. You can't, however, get away from the fact that Westminster Abbey is where it is, the British Museum's where it is, the Playfair Centre's where it is, you know, St George's Market's where it is. And I simply don't buy the notion that money that goes to restore the great icons of Britain's heritage doesn't in an important way benefit absolutely everybody who lives in this country, wherever they live. As to the mechanism, well, think of a better one. You know, we are not heritage experts. We have heritage experts who advise us, but we are grant givers. We're good at giving grants. We've been doing it for 11 years, and we know how to do that. And I think we do it in an efficient way. We certainly do it in a more cost-effective way than most other organisations I can think of. And if you've got a better mechanism, you can consult us about it. I don't suppose you'll get very far with that particular question, but anyway, that's my answer to you.
Next question. Yes.
Robert Paulson, Martin's College, Lancaster. I'll drop the compliment and ask you a question opposite in form to James Moore. I was quite struck by your statement about the Heritage Lottery Fund having protected funding, which protects the historic the Heritage Fund from the kind of people to sick donkeys lobby. And that actually does put you in a strong position to do some things which might not be popular. That the lottery ticket, after all, is not a tax, although sometimes it's called a tax. It's voluntarily given in the rational hope of gain, expectation of spending. In the case of churches, you have a whole set of heritage buildings of national importance whose congregations are in decline, who are not going to get a massive new audience anytime soon, and yet which have the custody of a network of the most important network of historic buildings, which are, you know, under genuine physical threat. If you do restore them, they're going to be around for 500 years. If that's sustainable enough. I'm not entirely sure about demanding new audiences. I mean, would the Department of Culture, Media and Sport fail to fund the kind of rap workshop in South London because it wasn't attracting enough retired ladies from rural areas? I just wondered if buildings which are unpopular currently, unfashionable and yet nonetheless important, if they are going to be supported, surely it's something like the Heritage Lottery Fund is going to have to do it. And if not you, who?
I completely agree with you. I've obviously given you completely the wrong impression. We are, I mean, outside the Church of England, we are the biggest funder of churches in the land. I agree with you. I think the estate of the Church of England, the condition of the estate of the Church of England, is one of the biggest threats to the heritage of England that there is. We are greatly exercised about that. We put in, with English Heritage, £25 million a year into the repair of churches. And we fund all sorts of, I mean, any church can apply to us under our normal grant programmes. We spend a lot of money on churches. There is a huge demand, and I think there needs to be, and we are part of the discussions trying to edge away towards that, a strategic solution to this. Trouble is, it's very difficult to be strategic in the Church of England because they have a totally anarchic structure from which they derive enormous strength, but it does make it very difficult to tackle a programme like this. But please do not think that we are anything other than passionate supporters of the estate of the church and its heritage importance. Not at all. It's easy to make jokes about outreach and attracting new audiences, but it's such a serious question. You know, you don't have to do it in a daft way. It just remind me, those jokes remind me of the early days of the women's movement, you know, and I got you. Eventually you get so fed up with people making those jokes. It's a serious matter. It really is a serious matter. You know, we had an application from a Republican group in Northern Ireland for a museum or an exhibition to commemorate Bloody Sunday. Now, that's an interesting question. And what we say to them is there's nothing that says you can't have a museum about Bloody Sunday, but your problem is going to have to be that you're going to have to think how to make that museum possible to enter and understand to someone who belongs to the other community. Now, that's a very stark example. But this challenge to make whatever it is, a park or a building, doesn't matter, interesting and accessible to people who aren't already interested in it is nothing but wonderful for the institution, I believe. It has brought people to do the most creative thinking that I've seen anywhere about how to meet this ridiculous condition that we set them. And I look around the place and I see how museums, for instance, in particular, have responded to this tiresome stuff. I know perfectly well they curse us uphill and down dale from time to time. But then you look, because all this money on the table, it's worth the effort, and they make the effort, and something wonderful happens. So I don't apologise for that at all. Are we free to be unpopular? Yes, of course we are. Almost every heritage organisation, except possibly parks, is unpopular with someone. But you know, the lovely thing about us is that it's for every someone that doesn't like it, there's a group of people who just have tears pouring down their cheeks because they're so happy, which is a very nice thing for us and not a usual plight for somebody to find themselves in when distributing public money. There's somebody.
Yes.
A woman at the back in there.
Consider one of the achievements of the fund to have devolved the authority to determine what heritage is from the experts to the lay community. And I don't necessarily disagree with that. I'm interested to know what you think the role of the expert is in all of this process and where expertise is actually functional or valuable in this process.
I don't want you to think that I'm advocating a substitution of one group for the other. What I'm arguing for, and what we have consistently tried to apply in our decision making, is a definition of the heritage where the expert view is there and important, but it is not the only view. And that when I first came to the Heritage Lottery Fund, we were just beginning to consult on the last strategic plan. We did some focus groups. And I said, let me go to a focus group somewhere and see what people are saying. So they sent me off to Newham, where they'd hired a bunch of school leavers to be the focus group. And they were perfectly intelligent, black and Asian kids, last year at school, I think. And when they got into that room and we told them that it was heritage we wanted them to be a focus group about, they just fell about laughing. And they said, why have you come to us? We live in Newham. We haven't got any heritage. And I found that absolutely and utterly shocking. Those kids had such a view, such a low view of their own culture and history, that of their neighbourhood, and such a lofty view of what they thought heritage was, that there was no connection between the two of them. And I thought that was simply awful. And after, of course, we started to talk, and after 3 hours, the whole room is papered with flip charts, with hundreds and hundreds of ideas. After their grandparents had come over on the Windrush, and their, you know, mothers had stories and all kinds of things, including, interestingly, the Victorian Hospital building in Newham, which was empty. And they were all very interested in this. Why? Suddenly interested in a Victorian, rather bog-standard Victorian hospital building, because they'd all been born in it. So from that, we have a really interesting discussion about buildings of different sorts and what to do with them. That is a long way of saying that I think it is completely indefensible for us as a country to be content with a definition of our heritage which belongs only to one section of the population, or which excludes some sections of the population from thinking that their past is worth enough to be called heritage. What's the role of the expert? Absolutely crucial to classify, to grade at the very top end of the heritage, to inform us, equip us with part of our mechanism for telling the best from the not best, the good from the bad, but not the only one. It's simply, all I'm saying is that because a building is not listed grade one or two, that should never be the end of the argument about how much heritage value it has, because there's all kinds of other reasons for which it might have that value. So, I mean, we pay tremendous. Our staff are expert, and we have expert advisors who advise us, and we value their advice very, very much indeed, and we pay great heed to it. But the image I like is the thickening the plot image. We don't exclude the expert advice, but we thicken the plot with the views of ordinary people.
Yes.
Do some people at the back here? Exactly what will be the effect of the Olympics on the Heritage Lottery Fund? Well, the first thing I say is it will be a huge opportunity. The Olympic Games is going to bring millions of visitors to Britain, and they will go all over the place, not just to the Thames Gateway. And it's already evident that all over the country, people in towns and villages and everywhere are waking up to this, because they're all coming, starting to apply to us and saying, look, we've got the Olympics are coming in 2012. We need to smarten up whatever their heritage asset is. And I think it's also, in an intangible sense, a very interesting ingredient in the heritage dialogue. The Olympic Games, particularly the way we sold our application, makes a nation start to ask itself questions about who we are, who are we presenting ourselves as? And that takes you very quickly into thinking about the buildings, the natural landscape, and all those other heritage questions. In practical terms, it will cost us money. In two ways. There is a strand of lottery tickets which will be entirely devoted to the Olympics, and so that revenue will not come to the other good causes. And secondly, there will be a direct contribution. We calculate, I don't think this is classified information, but I don't see why it should be. We calculate that between now and 2012, it will cost us about £125 million, both those things added together, mostly in the last sort of 3 or 4 years. Which in a way is a pity, because at the very time when there's, as I say, the Olympics are generating quite a lot of demand from people for money to make themselves look beautiful, is the time when we are going to be a bit less able to respond, but there it is.
But isn't this the very time you should be fighting against these cuts? You get a bigger cut rather than a smaller.
Well, indeed we are. That is, I was terribly self-denying in saying to you that we are the only people who are consulting at the moment. The Department of Culture, Media and Sport is also consulting at the moment. It may have closed down by now, but I pay no attention. They are consulting the public about the other good causes and how what sort of share the good causes should have, how that money should be distributed. So if any of you is moved to express a view that the Heritage Lottery Fund should maintain or even better increase its share, I would be extremely grateful for you to tell the Department of Culture, Media and Sport that, because I thought that was a bit of a vulgar bit of politics to introduce into this scholarly audience.
And it immediately raises the question at the end of a long day, whether a good sales pitch and described as a good piece of vulgar politicking is not indeed the note on which to draw to a conclusion.